back-to-school savings are officially in session at Tanger Outlets. Shop tax-free July 30th through August 8th and save up to 70% off the latest school styles. The best of apparel, footwear, accessories, and more. Save at Nike Factory Store, American Eagle, Gap Outlet, Crocs, Under Armour, Banana Republic Factory, and hundreds more. There's always something happening. Discover the latest fun and events all season long. Tanger Outlets, your savings destination.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Turned Into Punk Classics, a show where we take old episodes of Turned Into Punk that have been lost from the internet and return them to their previous glory by sticking them back on the feed. You can find this podcast on YouTube, TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, and all other forms of social media. Well, that's pretty much it. At Turned Into Punk, you can find me on Twitter or Instagram at LeftForDamien. I play in a band. More information can be found at fuckedup.cc. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy another TOAP classic. Jesse, thank you so much for doing this, man. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
I know it's weird because like I've met you a few times now and just gushed kind of a lot because, you know, we'll get into this because I shoehorn my way into all these episodes.
Okay.
But you had like a massive influence on what I wound up doing with my life. In a profound way, but this is not about my life as much as I like to pretend it is. This is about your life and punk rock. How'd you get into punk rock?
Well, I got into punk rock, I guess, my first exposure to punk rock would have been through my parents. My parents had a lot of punk records. My parents have a lot of records of all genres. My parents weren't punks, but they loved punk rock. I mean, they would have been, they weren't kids when punk came out. They were middle-aged when punk came out, and I was born when they were middle-aged, but they loved it, and but because no kid can, you know, grow up loving what their parents love, I had to find other things that I loved. So I discovered heavy metal, which I loved, but I always loved the rockier side of metal. Like, I loved Faster Pussycat and Motley Crue and, you know,
the glamier
stuff. Yeah, Hanoi Rocks is one of my favorites. I like the glamier stuff, and at some point in time, I remember hearing, I think I heard Megadeth cover the Sex Pistols, they covered Holidays in the Sun, I believe, and I remember hearing Skid Row covered Megadeth too on some sort of it was like a benefit for cancer research, some compilation. I can't remember Skid Row, and I thought that's the best song I ever heard them did, you know. And I remember talking to my mom and being like, "Who's the Sex Pistols?" She's, "Well, I got their record," and my mom, gave me Nevermind the Bollocks, and then and I loved it because everybody loves Nevermind the Bollocks.
It's an unbelievable
insane
record.
But then, and then she gave me the New York Dolls first record, and I actually didn't like the record as a whole, just because I was in, you know, grade 7, and it was maybe a little bit mature for me, or like, you know, the nuance of it just wasn't obvious to me. But I love Personality Crisis. I love the first song, and I heard that, and I thought, that's what Faster Pussycat and Poison and all these bands, especially on their first albums before they kind of became more cock rock. I was like, that was clearly the influence, and I was keen on it. And I got into the Dolls more later on. So yeah, I think that was kind of like heavy metal led me to punk rock, and a lot of my peers, like my bandmates when I was a teenager, it was a similar story for them.
How old would you have been at this point?
I guess I was about 12 years old when I started becoming exposed to punk rock. I mean, I always knew it existed and stuff, but
when you started kind of adopting it yourself a little bit.
Yeah, and just accepting the fact that maybe I was into something that was older as well, because the first punk bands I got into would have been Ramones, Sex Pistols, you know, New York Dolls, you know, and actually not The Clash so much until I was actually a little later on. But
and that's funny because that comes up a lot in this podcast, that whole thing of, and it seems like, you know, like, and I like The Clash, but I really love the Sex Pistols.
Yeah, yeah.
And it seems like you either are drawn to one or the other.
Well, I think a lot of people resist the Sex Pistols because of their immense popularity. That kind of goes against the attraction of discovering something obscure that you can find in punk. But at the end of the day, whether, you know, the Sex Pistols were major label sellouts or whatever they were, Nevermind the Bollocks sounds super punk, and lyrically it's certainly punk, and and I mean it's genre defying if anything. Yeah. I mean, they didn't invent it. I guess when the Ramones first came to England, like, John Lydon was so starstruck, he was like, he couldn't even speak to them. He was like, oh my God, like my heroes are here, you know? But, you know.
But they definitely codified it in a big way.
And they ran with it, and they really, and they also, the mainstream exposure that put it into the limelight of everyone else on Earth is a major, major, major feat, you know? Because it's offensive, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, there's some questionable lyrics on that record.
But it's challenging in a way that, you know, like obviously now it wouldn't fly, but it's challenging. Like, it's not offensive to just offend you.
No.
Necessarily. Well, probably at some point.
At times, I think
it is. Definitely by the second record, it is, too.
Yeah, for sure. But it's also good rock and roll.
Unbelievable rock and roll.
Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there. But,
no.
Sorry. So after getting into sort of these bands, what was your first kind of exposure to the idea that this carried on? Because, you know, I guess you're around my age, so this would have been the 90s.
Yeah.
What was your first exposure to local bands or newer contemporary bands that were kind of doing the same thing?
You know, it was the local all-ages scene, really. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm trying to think here. I guess the exposure to the local scene, if I recall correctly, was Andy Dixon, the guitar player in DBS with me as well. Me and him and I, we saw like a bulletin board at the high school or something, which is like contribute to a fanzine. I don't know why we wanted to contribute to a fanzine exactly, but for some reason, I guess we knew about punk and we heard there was going to be a punk fanzine or something, and it was like, you know, get together with other kids from different high schools and get together at the local community center and you can learn how to make a punk fanzine.
Well, so it was like a coordinated effort?
Yeah, it was like a coordinated thing for like the North Shore, you know, the North Vancouver Rec Commission.
Wow.
And so we got there, and when we got there, there was a bunch of kids that were like 1 year older than us that had already discovered cool underground punk, and they were like, wow, this, like, I was 13 and Andy was 12 or whatever, right? And we showed up and they were like, oh, you guys like the Sex Pistols and the Ramones, well, you know, you really got to hear, you know, Jawbreaker and Fugazi. You know, like, you know, check out like some stuff that's more underground. And we went, you know, we'd already started playing music and stuff, but we were like, you know, of course Nirvana was an influence and, you know, it was a little bit punk because we, that's, you know, what we could pull off. Mm-hmm. And it was also a little bit metal and a little bit grunge. We didn't know what we were doing and hadn't fully solidified our interests musically that way. But anyways, we want to do a show, and this really awesome woman who's still very much a part of everyone in Vancouver's life, a woman named Trish Kelly, who's a political activist in Vancouver, and has had a lot of she's just a very, very important person in the Vancouver community to this day. Well, she was there, and she was like, well, I'll book your band. It's gonna be my birthday. It's my 16th birthday or whatever it was, and I'm gonna do 5 bands for $2, and your band can open. And we were like, awesome. So we recorded, you know, a demo on a cassette deck.
So was this DBS bar?
This is DBS, yeah, our first show. And
so I guess
we were already playing.
How did
really.
You come together with DBS? How did you meet everyone?
Well, we all went to high school. We all went to elementary school together.
Yeah.
So both Paul and Andy and I, we all were into heavy metal together. I guess we became friends because those guys were all 1 year younger than me and still are 1 year younger than me. But I was in grade 5 and they were in grade 4. And like those two guys liked heavy metal and I liked heavy metal and no one else did because we were super young, right? Everybody else liked the New Kids on the Block.
Yeah.
So naturally we became friends and, you know, and just started watching the Power Hour on Much Music. Back then it was... Yeah, the Pepsi Power Hour.
Power Hour,
Dan Gallagher, and you know, and what's her name
Teresa
before Dan?
Teresa Roncon.
Teresa Roncon, and before Dan, there was a woman with red hair. Anyways,
Who was that? What was her name?
I can't remember now. But anyways, we loved it all. So that's how we became friends. So I guess really through that little fancy network we got discovered, and that girl who invited us to play our first show, she took me to see Fugazi, and I saw Fugazi and Sparkmarker and Mecha Normal at the Plaza of Nations in Vancouver, and it was $6, and there was 3,000 people there. It was absolutely huge.
So that's one of your first, is that your first
big
show?
That was the second probably like punk show I ever went to. The first would have been a local show at our community center, a brand new unit.
BNU.
Yeah, BNU, who was a wicked melodic hardcore band who I loved. And that was actually the first 7-inch record I ever got. I bought a record player so I could buy the BNU 7-inch because they didn't have CDs or tapes.
Yeah. My friend came to Vancouver when we were kids and I'm like, he's like, what do you want me to pick up? And obviously we're super into you guys and Gob had just come out by that point. Yeah. So I'm like, BNU, Brand New Unit, because I'd seen the video on the Wedge.
Sweet.
And he got me the thing. But anyway, go
Super
on.
Super sweet, yeah. So that was our first show, and we were just, you know, moshing and going crazy. Yeah. So we're just like, holy shit, this is just great. You know, that was in the spring, and by summertime, we were just like, you know, just record store house, you know, just like give it all and going to every local show. Just like, and playing a lot of shows too, playing all the time, you know.
So, you know, you guys were pretty young though when you recorded that first, the 7-inch is the first, after the demo, the 7-inch.
There was actually 3 albums before that, even all cassette only releases.
Really?
Yeah, Tales from the Crib was our 4th album. Wow. We had 3 albums, a 7-songer, an 8-songer, and a 15-songer. They are all on our, I created a Bandcamp page for it last year.
Those are on there too?
They're all on there, everything. They were limited to, I think it was 100 copies of one tape, 50 of the other, and 400 copies of the final tape before we made a real CD. We had been recording, like, we were 15 when we made Tales from the Crib, or 15 and 14 maybe, and we'd been recording since we were 12, 13 years old, so.
So what's that process of making your first tape? Like, how'd you know, like, because you're so young.
Well, I think we wanted to open for Strain, a straight-edge hardcore band that we loved.
That Puss had put out records for, too.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that for some reason we felt that we needed a recording to do it, or, oh, no, it was some other show that they wanted a demo and we didn't have one. And then my dad was just like, he just looked at in the back of the Georgia Strait, and, you know, just like the local rig, and just said like, oh, this place is, you know, $10 an hour, it's $100 a day. And so, you know, we'd already played 3 shows and got paid $100 each show. He's like, well, you guys can afford this one. My dad came and dropped us down at the recording studio. It was down kind of by the base of the Granville Street Bridge. And Benny Carlos was the engineer, and he was super nice, kind of a weird dude, but kind of a nice dude. And upstairs there was like all this like seedy roommates as a house studio.
Yeah.
And like one of the guys was like, I don't know, shooting up and like just like a rough, like a, just a classic rough like Vancouver punk rock like scene. We went in there and just did it, you know. And yeah, it was really fun. And I still think of a lot of the recording techniques he used and think about how it's so weird. Like, what? he has some weird ideas. And I never really... I remember one time working with Cecil English on our CDs, playing him the old demo tapes, because he never heard them. And his mind was blown. He was like, this guy's ideas are crazy. He's like, this guy's a genius. This is way better than anything I've ever done for you. He was just like, this is the coolest shit ever.
Now I got to check out these Bandcamp recordings.
It's all there. It's all free. So anybody wants it. All our music is free. So if anybody's interested, just go crazy.
One of the big defining things I think about a lot of the lyric writing, especially on Tales from the Crib, and even the imagery that you kind of used, was like, the graffiti, the hateful graffiti about you guys in school and stuff like that. When did that start for you guys? Because was it when you're 12 and 13 getting into punk rock, or is it a little later on? Obviously, it's a short window here we're talking about. But.
Well, elementary school kids, you know, I mean, all kids are cruel on some level. Elementary school kids, though, tend to not be too hateful, in circumstances. Teenagers get, you know, begin to develop a sense of identity amongst themselves and are looking to define themselves from one another, and therefore, you know, use their ego to act out, you know, different behavior to... You know, to try to find where they fit in society. And this isn't wrong, you know. It's wrong if you hurt somebody, but it's not wrong to be that person. And I never actually felt persecuted in high school or anything like that. But I think it was just kind of like there was people that we thought in our, you know, young, also arrogant, you know, and ignorant minds, we thought that they were, you know, that their opinions of people or their opinions of life were less than ours. And so when they would tease us for whatever differences we had with them, we'd choose to shame them as much as possible and we had quite a lot of friends, like, despite the fact that we were like, you know, like the outcasts of the school. We had there was a lot of outcasts in our school. We went to a really big high school too, 1,500 people. Like there was at least a few hundred that were.
Is that where that gym show video of you guys playing is happening? And there's all like, it's like so many kids. It's like a gym. It's like a hometown show.
I doubt it. I don't, because I don't remember ever playing in our, we did play in our high school one time. We played out in the courtyard one time at lunchtime, but we never, I don't remember ever playing in the gym.
Right? It's like some big hall. Anyway, sorry.
Yeah, I don't know. I would have to look.
Yeah, okay. Okay, like sorry.
Oh, no worries.
Sorry, so, you're playing in high school. This wasn't as much of an issue.
Yeah, it wasn't too much. I think for me, I was kind of a class clown, so it's like, you know, I didn't have as many enemies because I like to entertain people.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I was just the entertainer guy, and I was like, I was in choir class, and I was into like, you know, and we were all into art classes, and you know, just like, I don't know, I feel like most people, you know, I think also just because like we had like a video on much music and stuff like that, people were like, these guys are like up to something, you know, mm-hmm. like it was weird that. We would go on tour, like we'd take an extra week off spring break and be on tour and just do things that other kids weren't doing. So I think that some of the jocks for sure hated us, but a bunch of them thought it was cool what we were doing too. Yeah, I don't really have negative memories of it too much at all. But yeah, so the imagery though, as far as the suburbs and the vibe of them as a whole, that I can say there was definitely some people that felt threatened by you know, us having friends or us having a community, I think, was threatening to a lot of people that, especially like teenagers, often they feel lost. And as they're looking for their identity, maybe that's why they get involved with gangs or that's why they get involved in different things. It's because they're trying to find something, right? Because you don't know who you are yet. Mm-hmm. And we found out who we were so early. But then you look back and then when you're adult, you're like, oh, we had no idea who we were. You know, we were complete maniacs. Like, our ideas are totally unfounded. But it's at the time we were pretty sure we knew who we were.
So what were your first kind of like strikeout on the road type moments? Like, were you guys touring on those tapes or was it not till Tales from the Crypt?
Not till... I don't think Tales from the Crib would have been out when we did our first tour. We did some out-of-town shows. Like, we'd done Edmonton and Calgary, and we'd done a couple of shows in Washington State. And then we went on tour with Gob. And Gob were not a much music sensation yet, and neither were we.
Before we get to that, though, I think you were already on Much Music by that point, because the very first... I went looking the other day for video clips on Much Music that are just clips of you guys that I remember.
Oh, with Teresa Ronca.
Teresa Ronca at a skate park here.
Yes, that would have been... That's
before Tales from the Crib, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That was the summer we recorded Tales from the Crib, and it came out the following spring. It took us 9 months to get the album out because the artwork and the mastering and saving the money and you know all the other things that you know, just takes time.
Yeah.
But, so I would say that we were on Much Music, and we were probably on the local news, but it would have made probably a small splash at that point. You know,
because
we didn't have a record for sale, you know, yet or anything. When Tales from the Crib came out finally a year later... It immediately sold a lot of records. Like there was a lot of anticipation around it coming out locally. And we went into Track Records, like the local punk record store, a couple days after it came out. And the guy from Track was like, I think that was our fastest selling local release we've ever put out around here. Like, he was like, we sold a ton of those this week.
Well, because how did that first Much Music appearance thing come about? Because that is like, it just seems, I don't know when was the last time you checked it out, and obviously you probably don't have any interest in watching yourself as
No, a kid. I have watched that, actually.
Okay, yeah.
Someone posted it on my Facebook wall, and of course I
clicked. They force you to watch it.
I don't go hot and out this stuff necessarily, but of course I'm curious.
But like, how did that come about? Because like, you guys are, you know, and obviously the songs are already there that you guys are playing, so it makes sense that they would focus on you guys. But
well, I think we'd played some good local shows at that point, and we'd ended up getting, you know, we'd started our own record label with this woman, Marzi Damien, and she was very proactive at contacting people. Like, she was just one of those people that has a knack for talking to people, and I think that she'd somehow got, she had a friend maybe that worked in Much Music, or you know, or she just maybe called him up and said, oh, I heard you're bringing the new music to Vancouver, you should interview these guys.
I think it was Power 30 or New Music?
Maybe it was Power 30. I thought it was maybe New Music.
They probably reprofiled.
It might have actually been both.
Yeah, they might have repurposed the clips and stuff.
Exactly, yeah. I don't remember now. I felt like when I watched that clip on YouTube, I felt like it said the new music, but again, I can't really remember. But anyways, so it was just one of those random flukes. And that summer we had all these kind of flukes like that. Like, we won like a battle of the bands and won the recording time at the studio with Cecil. But he didn't know that yet. Like, he didn't know who had won the battle of the bands. And he was just at one of our gigs another night and saw us and was like, you guys are great. I want to give you a free day recording studio time. And we're like, what studio do you run? He says, Profile. We're like, we already have a free day to studio. He's like, oh, well, now you got two. So then we're like, well, we're going in and we're going to make a full length.
Yeah.
You know, so I think we just had like a lot of luck. And we were all of us and Marzi as well. We were putting a lot of energy into it. Like, we were, yeah, I was definitely like, I was, I was going for it.
Yeah.
I was like, I'm gonna put a sticker on every friggin' pole. I'm gonna like poster the heck out of our shows. I'm gonna book all the local bands, do sound for them, record demos for ourselves and everyone else. Like, I was just like, I had tons of energy to burn.
You guys were part of that circuit of bands too, that were the bands that just after kind of Green Day exploded, were the wave of bands like, I'm talking Rancid, AFI, Swingin' Utters.
Even just a little bit before.
No, you guys were obviously existed before.
Green Day existed before DBS, but they weren't popular before we'd become locally popular.
But I mean,
we were big fans of them from the beginning.
Yeah.
Like the guys at the local skate shop turned me on to Green Day. Like, they were like, you like Descendants? You gotta hear 1039 Green Day. And I bought it. I was like, man, if these guys ever get on the radio, they're going to be huge, because these songs are so good, you know, and I still love that album.
No, but I meant the bands that were, like, the bands that everyone who was turned on by this music turned to next, like, the next wave of bands that people got into. When did that network start? Like, when did you start playing with AFI and Swingin' Utters and Rancid?
Well, actually, we would have played with AFI, and Swingin' Utters. We played them both at the same time. Both those bands came up to Vancouver, and they didn't have any fans really in Vancouver yet. Or I think some of the street punks knew about the Swingin' Utters, but AFI were definitely, like, nobody knew about them. They were a brand new band. They would have been touring their first record. And they were they needed a local band to play with, and someone said, you guys should play at DBS, and we booked three shows for them. We did a bar show with them, and then we booked them at the local skate shop, at a record shop, and we played an all-ages show at a skate park, and we did three shows with them. And then they're like, well, whenever you're down in California, you can come crash with us, come stay with us, and we took them up on the offer. We hit them up, and Rancid, like, we met them. That's actually a really interesting story. There's time for it.
Absolutely.
We were playing with AFI at Gilman in Berkeley, and AFI were already the biggest local band. They were like, they'd bring 400 or 500 people at Gilman, like a packed show.
If anyone who hasn't been there is packed out Gilman.
Yeah, it's like, it's a
300 person comfortable.
Yeah,
venue.
For sure. And so we got to open for them because we'd hooked them up in Vancouver. And then we didn't have a place to stay after the show because for whatever reason, I don't know why. Or it might have even been that we were there again a month later. I don't know what it was. But we didn't have a place to stay. And we looked in Max and Rock and Roll because they had crash pads listed, people that would be willing to let you crash if you didn't have a place to stay. So we actually just, at like 2 in the morning, we called this crash pad number and said, And the guy was like, yeah, totally, come stay. And we come, and the guy lets us into the door, and we go, and we start lying and putting our sleeping bags on the floor. And then this guy shows up, and this woman, and they're like, and the woman was like, oh, I think, are you guys from Vancouver? You guys are DBS, right? And we're like, yeah. She's like, I'm Justine from Whorehouse of Representatives from Seattle. We played together a few weeks ago. And I was like, oh, hey. And then I was like to the guy, I was like, hey, my name's Jesse. What's your name? And he goes, oh, I'm Lynn. You know, and I'm like, oh, are you from Rancid? He's like, yeah, I'm from Rancid. I was like, oh, sweet. He goes, yeah, Brett from Rancid lives here too. And like, their house was just the local crash pad house. And then we ended up talking with them, and they were super nice, of course. And he was just like, hey, next time we come up to tour Canada, maybe you guys should open for us. And I was like, my mind is being blown because they're my favorite. They're my favorite band.
This is pre-Let's Go, right? This would be just Rancid self-titled.
This is right when Let's Go came out. Actually, okay. I saw Rancid on the Rancid tour. Yeah. Actually, I saw them after their first 7-inch, the Lookout 7-inch that came and toured Vancouver just before Rancid came out.
Okay.
And that was the summer I really got into punk rock.
Wow, okay.
They played at the Hastings Street Community Center right across from the P&E, right by where we are right now.
Yeah.
And I saw them with the Ripcords, Rancid and the Ripcords, and it was awesome. And I loved both the bands, and I bought both their 7-inches.
And Ripcords is pre Tribe Called Red.
Is it?
Jay played in Ripcord's one of the lineups.
No way! Yeah. I did not know that.
Yeah, it all comes back to punk rock.
Interesting.
You know?
All right. Yeah, and then the Rancid album came out like 2 weeks after that tour, or maybe it was already out and I didn't have the money to buy it. Whatever it was, I got it a couple weeks later, and it's my favorite album. I loved it so much, actually, that Let's Go was actually a disappointment to me, even though it's a great album, too.
I can see that. Rancid's a harder-hitting record.
Oh, man, I just love that album.
Was Tales from the Crib out by this point? Or?
No, but that would have been the summer we recorded it, so it would have come out a year later. But Tales of the Crypt was out for sure when we stayed at their house.
Yeah, okay.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we would have been just about to put out the second one, probably.
Okay.
Yeah.
So back to Tales from the Crypt. So that record comes out, and I think I remember reading an article in Chart Magazine about you guys. Mm-hmm. I remember you played a song, I think, live on The Wedge?
Yeah, we played live on Much Music. Two songs we played?
Two songs, with Sookie and Lee. Yeah, Sookie and Lee was those. I think it was The Wedge, and it would have been just kind of shortly into her tenure at Much Music.
Yeah, she would have been probably 1 year in or something like that, or two, yeah. Yeah, she's really nice.
Oh, absolutely. Did you know her from out here? Because Bob's Your Uncle?
I knew the band Bob's Your Uncle, but I was never familiar with their music. I'd seen their posters around town.
Yeah.
You know, I knew who they were, and I knew that it was a Vancouverite that had, you know, taken over the show, or started the show.
What was that tour like across Canada for you guys as kids? Like,
who drove? I did basically all the driving. I was the only person who was 16. Everybody else was 15 because I'm a year older.
Yeah.
So I drove, and this woman, Marzi, who put out the records, she drove. And and she was maybe 19. Or
yeah, Neffer. How did Neffer record? I guess before we get there.
She started it. It was her thing, and this other woman, Cheryl, and I helped out too. And we were kind of the first and only band on it for a while, and Gob did a 7-inch on it. And then they did a couple of other records that didn't.
They did a band with keyboards. They had like a piano or keyboards as like the main instrument.
It wasn't Itch. That was Network. They had the Cowards, but not Cowards, and not the local Vancouver band that's currently called the Cowards.
Yeah,
but a band
Cowards.
That back then was called the Cowards, and they were talented songwriters, but I'm not sure if the record really took off.
So the 7-inch is the first release on Neffer, the Snowball 7-inch, I guess?
Yeah, it was. And then Tales
from the Crypt kind of comes out.
Totally, and actually, probably the Snowball 7-inch, the first Gob 7-inch, which came out. Yeah, the first Gob 7-inch, and then it would. Yeah, probably. Maybe the Gob 7-inch was called Soda. Maybe
I don't know. Wasn't Soda?
No.
Was it the one with the green giant on the cover, or the
it
one
was the one with the green giant, on the
or
cover.
A penis like a no. giant dildo?
A dildozer. It was dildozer. Dildozer. That was
that's
the one.
It.
Yes,
that's
thank
it.
You. Yeah. So yeah, that was the second Gob 7-inch. The green beans was the previous one. I think it was the second Gob 7-inch. And Gob took us on tour, and that was our first Gob tour.
You opened for Gob on that tour?
No, we did a different tour even before that.
Oh,
summer.
Okay.
We toured to California for 2 weeks with Gob. They put us in their van, and none of us drove. We were 15 and 14. Then, because my birthday's in May, and we went down over spring break, which is in whatever it's April or whatever.
Yeah,
and we toured with Gob, and all of us in one van, and they were like, you know, all their 20s, and even one of them was in their 30s.
Yeah, the drummer was like in his 30s.
Yeah, and we were like 14, at like getting drunk as. Can I swear on this?
Getting
drunk as fuck for the first time. Like, the first night of the tour in California, we're just, like, sucking back, like, 40s old English, puking everywhere. Like, just, like, killers on the loose. Like, seriously. Like, just horrible young people.
How did you meet those guys? Were they just playing local shows?
I think that maybe it was through Neffer. I think that she wanted to put them out. Because Gob were just getting their career going. They were new. They didn't have a CD out yet or anything. I don't know how. But I think it was probably Neffer that was just like, oh, I'm going to put up both these 7-inches. And Gob had toured one time before. They'd done California like 6 months before. And they're like, we're going to do it again. And we're going to put you guys in the van.
Wow.
And we played together, seen each other live. But my parents like smuggled us across the border.
I was going to say, what did your parents say?
Gob brought all the gear the night before.
Yeah.
Oh, no, Gob brought all the gear the second day. The night before, my dad put us all in his SUV and drove us down to Blaine and put us in a hotel room and just left. And he was like,
see you guys later.
And we waited for Gob to sneak the gear across the... Oh, yeah, they were going to go record. Maybe they had friends to jam with in Seattle.
Yeah,
or whatever
yeah.
the bullshit's supposed to be. Before the internet, you could lie all you wanted.
Yeah, before
awesome.
They could Google
yeah,
you.
Yeah, yeah. Before Google, they could lie. And you could lie all you wanted. And there was no evidence to back anything up.
Yep.
But, and then it all went according to plan, and we did it. And, we were just assholes. So, yeah. And we had a great tour, though. We played with, like, a bunch of bands that we learned to, like, know later on. Like, all kinds of stuff, yeah.
Who were some of the bands you guys would have been playing with back then at that time? Because it would have been, like... Just before all that stuff kind of pre-Warp Tour, when all that stuff kind of blew up for a moment, like, would you have been playing with
we played with Schlong?
Oh, yeah, And another Operation Ivy, ex-Operation Ivy.
Uh-huh. Right? We played with Schlong on that tour, and we played with, I keep wanting to say we played with Falling Sickness, but it wasn't.
No,
it
was that would be later.
What was another big L.A. ska punk band that we got to open for?
Sort of Jelly Beans?
No, I thought I was thinking Mighty Mighty Boss Tones.
No, they're from Boston.
Okay. Oh, man, I just can't remember right now for some reason. I remember Dance the night Crashers? Before Das... No, no. Or maybe what was it? Now I don't remember. I remember the night before No Doubt played. They weren't a big band yet. We were playing the same clubs as No Doubt.
Yeah.
Like, they were still a local... They were actually a real local band.
Yeah.
Like, they were from the fucking punk scene, believe it or not. And it's really hard to imagine now. But they were. I have a poster that was like DBS and Gob and whatever, and then the previous night's No Doubt and whoever, and it's like
Skanking Pickle.
Yeah, it might have been them, but it wasn't. Anyways, I can't remember right now. My brain is drawing a blank. But and I remember a few other groups too, but probably none that would be relevant to anybody listening to this because they'd be just washed away.
That, believe me, that's all these listeners care about is these bands that aren't relevant.
Yeah.
People have asked me to like start writing down every band I mentioned so they can go back and check it out again. And I'm like, it's a lot of bands.
We did play with one wicked band, though. We played with Pansy Division at Gilman Street.
Yeah.
And it was packed. And we got to play for, like 300 or 400 people at Gilman Street. And it was like the third or second night of our tour. And maybe even the first night of our tour. Like, we might have driven straight and not done Seattle and Portland.
Okay.
I can't remember. But that was just like, you can imagine the vibe at a Pansy Division show in Berkeley in 92. It was, or 93. It was just so much fun.
Oh, it would have been incredible.
And we made fans that night for life.
Did they have the Mint Records connection? Not yet, right? That's
not
like
quite
later.
Yet, because that would have been maybe the next year, like as punk was getting bigger and people were selling more records. And Lookout had Green Day's back catalog was selling. That's when Mint sold a ton of Cub records.
Yeah.
And DBS sold a ton of Tales of Crib records. We were on Mint, but like local bands were selling a ton of pop punk records. And that's when the Berkeley, like Vancouver connection was kind of existing that way. So,
When the record comes out and you guys start that tour across Canada, mm-hmm. with Gob opening for you at this point.
That tour was not with Gob. Across Canada, we went on our own.
Oh, you did?
We traveled alone.
So you did that before. You did do a tour with Gob at some point,
Gob
right?
was our first tour to California, and then we went across Canada alone. We
did
never
you
toured...
play Gob with Gob at Classic Studios in Toronto? For the first time you guys played Classics, I think Gob opened.
We might have played a few shows with Gob here and there across Canada, but it would have been a coincidence.
Up. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, it would have been meeting up, or maybe we did a few dates, but I'm pretty sure that across Canada we went alone.
Because I'm 90%
summer.
Sure there's Elma Combo graffiti that says DBS Gob tour and stuff, and I back, I'm sure that graffiti unfortunately is long gone.
There's probably fans that are like, Jesse Gunner's lost his fucking mind. He has no idea what he's talking about. The guy's old as the hills.
I am
like,
digging up the most minor memories that you have.
Well, no, they're actually significant memories.
Yeah.
You'd think that I'd know them, but if it seems odd that I don't know all of them, it's just that because we did so many shows.
Well, that's
so
the thing,
tours.
You're so young.
We did 900 shows over the course of about 7 years. And we toured so much. Like, we toured 1 year. The year that we graduated high school, we did 5.5 months straight. There is a lot of overlapping memories.
Mm-hmm.
And the memories later on into our career are for sure more vivid than the ones when I was, like, 14. Like, my brain was still growing. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
that's right. Well,
like,
part two will have a lot more vivid memories. Because believe me, part one, I think we're just at Tales of the Crib. We're going to have so much more to go.
There's a lot of stories.
You guys tour Canada at that point.
Yeah.
What were those shows like? Because I guess you're playing Classic Studios, I know, example, is a smaller venue, but, like,
mm-hmm.
you had a TV profile, like, as a kid, because this is the point where I get into the music. I get into punk rock, 93, by 94, I'm going to shows, DBS came to town, I remember it was the premiere of Beyond Rangoon,
yeah.
you played Classic Studios,
mm-hmm.
I don't know why I remember there was the premiere of the movie Beyond Rangoon that night, because I think we had to go to it first.
Well, the thing that happened was that, DBS, that summer we've spoken of, we got a ton of exposure on various mediums. And then Tales from the Crib came out and became a local, buzzy record. And nationally across Canada, we got exposure from having a video on Much Music and playing live on Much Music, which also was on that tour.
Yeah.
But as soon as we started to gain any kind of national recognition, at that point in time, we set a bunch of rules for our band where we said, we're only playing DIY shows, we're only playing all ages shows, we're not playing bars, we're not working with booking agents, we're booking everything ourselves, we're not going to work with anybody in the industry, we're just going to do our own thing.
Mm-hmm.
When it came to the media, we were still down. We were still like, okay, we'll play Much Music, we'll play you know, we'll get interviewed by any magazine. Like, all the press is great. Mm-hmm. But we're like, we're only going to do DIY shows. And Marzi and I booked the first tours. And after that, she left and I booked all the rest of myself. Wow. And I just, like, we just decided, I think it was because, again, like, the Fugazi and the DIY punk mm-hmm. ethic, we got really, really into that on a philosophical level. It was really important to Andy and myself and also important to the other guys as well. But I think that being political became important to us, and I think that also a lot of people probably, there's always some backlash when your band gets popular where they'll say, oh, those guys are just a bunch of teenagers from North Van, they got rich parents, they're just a bunch of posers, you know, whatever people would say, and we're like, we're not posers, we mean punk rock, we love it, and mm-hmm. and we believe in this community and the scene, and we're going to prove it through the way that we operate as a band. And and so as a result of that, a lot of those shows were weird. Like, you know, we mostly all ages hall shows, or, you know, the odd, like, yeah, all kind of random shows. And it was, you know, by the next year, things became more consistent. But,
yeah.
But, like, also, I used to, like, can we talk about drug abuse on the show?
Totally.
Okay, I used to smoke tons of pot when I was a teenager. Actually,
on this show, that's not even drug abuse. That's medication.
So I was getting baked all the time. Yeah. I was, like, yeah. You know, like, into, like, you know, other things as teenagers are into, yeah. You know, and I had tons of distractions, like, outside of DBS, and I had a ton of energy to focus onto it, but I was not the most organized person. Like, I kept, like, a shitty, like, book of, like, phone numbers of random dudes in different towns, and, like, the way I operated this was chaos. Like, I never had a computer or used one until I was 21 years old. I just kept scraps of paper and shoeboxes and just, like, booked these tours, and, like, it was chaos. Like, had I been better at organizing, or if we'd had, like, an agent or something, then we probably could have been one of these, like, Fat Records type bands, yeah. With their perfect tours and their riders and all this shit. But we just wanted to do, like, we wanted to do chaotic all-ages shows, and we wanted to screw around and just, like, yeah, just be crazy, kind of just do things a little bit more anarchistically.
Well, that. Your politics totally informed my politics in a very direct way, like the way you guys operate as a band and stuff. But I guess you talk about those Fat Records bands. After Tales from the Crypt kind of had success, did you guys get approached by a lot of those big major punk labels at that point, which are just kind of emerging, I guess, at this point?
Yeah, surprisingly not too many. You know, BYO approached us, and I really admired a lot of bands on BYO.
I remember you were a huge Youth Brigade fan.
Yeah, I love Youth Brigade.
You guys used to cover Youth Brigade, right?
Maybe we did. I don't remember if we did or we didn't, but we toured with Youth Brigade, and I really loved, like, the Stern Brothers, and I used to, like, watch, like, Mom, you know, like, what's the
what is it now? I'm just like
Another State of Mind.
Okay,
and, you know, I idolized that, and Another State of Mind was an influence to me too, because I remember just seeing them tour Canada DIY in '81. Like, I loved it.
Did you know that they were Canadian then?
No, I didn't. Actually.
They're actually from Toronto.
That's crazy. Yeah, yeah. I moved to LA. I learned that later on. But you know, surprisingly not. I think maybe it's because we already had a label that we were on, and also because we were young and, like, you know, maybe, you know, we were maybe a little more, like, volatile than, like, a more, like, established band. And I think also being Canadian too, like, you know, you're not, you know, it's a different world up here. And I think, like, if we'd been that popular in, you know, LA or the Bay Area or something, probably we'd be on Epitaph or something.
Yeah.
But it wasn't really, we didn't have a lot of it. Or if we did, I didn't know about it. You mm-hmm. know, we did have a manager, right? So, you know, and she had interest of keeping us on her label.
Yeah.
So maybe that could have been a conflict of interest. But whether it was or it wasn't, I don't really care. But, who knows? Yeah, anyone's guess.
So once you kind of got back from Tales from the Crib, mm-hmm. or from that tour across Canada, and you went to America, I assume, too, a little bit?
Yeah, tons. Yeah, I mean, that summer we did most of the States, but, yeah, no, we started hitting the States pretty hard, like, yeah. Right after that. Yeah, we were touring all the time, because you could just sneak right across the border. How they let a bunch of 15- and 16-year-olds across the border, I don't know.
It's a different time, right?
But we were just, we're recording, and we're recording in Minnesota. We always just, like, come with some random, like, you know, random story and get a fake letter that I write myself the night before.
Yeah.
Put it together real quick and, like, just, like, oh man, we just broke so many laws. Like, I'd never break so many laws now.
No, but I guess I think now, well, maybe it's harder to be a band. I was gonna say it's easier to be a band because about the organizational stuff you were talking about.
Yeah.
But it's hard to be a band because there's not a lot of tricks you can use anymore.
No, and I'm not into it. You know, I'm not into lying. Like, I'm into being in a band. I am in a band. But I just, I'm not, like, I don't think I'd lie at the border.
Into the scams.
No.
Well, because it's just, like, it seems so much more high stakes now. Like, lying at the border.
Banned for 5 years.
Yeah. Or maybe it's because you're a kid, but it just seems like lying at the border, there's, like, what are they going to do? Tell me I can't go in?
Yeah.
But then
yeah.
you're like, no, they'll throw me in a detention center for like 6 months.
Yeah, that's right. Or I'll go to jail or like all the black mark on my permanent yeah. record. A record that'll last for the rest of my life. Yeah, no, I don't know. Yeah.
What was it like when you got home, though, was like as a band that's kind of like toured?
Yeah, we were just like, I mean, high school is just getting in the way.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
pretty much.
Yeah.
But we all still graduated and did pretty good. I mean, I didn't really graduate, but I mean, I got a diploma, I graduated with a 51% C minus average, you know. But I was recording all the time mm-hmm. and writing like all the time. And yeah, like just, yeah, we were touring a lot. So I actually didn't get my math 10. I failed that. But then the principal was like, my daughter and I had seen you on Much Music, and we know you've been working hard at other things, so we're going to give you 51% in Math 10, you know, because it's a prerequisite graduate.
That's the best perk that anyone...
And he gave me my high school diploma.
That's the best perk anyone's ever gotten from Much Music.
Totally, yeah.
Save on O'Reilly Brake Parts Cleaner. Get 2 cans of O'Reilly Brake Parts Cleaner for just $8. Valid in-store only at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
But no, it was just, we were doing stuff all the time in Vancouver yeah. too, and getting out for weekends. We'd go to like Vancouver Island back then, because right after that, you know, Green Day exploded, mm-hmm. and like every small town anywhere had a punk scene with 200 punks. Like it was like literally there was times we'd play Vancouver Island where we, not just Victoria or Victoria Nanaimo, but Courtney, Comox, Campbell River, Duncan, you know, like
the places the rest of us don't know about.
Sydney, yeah. you know, like we're actually playing like the towns in between the towns
yeah.
on an island that doesn't have that many people. And you know, and British Columbia, like yeah, everywhere, you know, Kamloops and Kelowna and Vernon and Trail, you know, like just like hitting them all. And there was, you know, yeah, everywhere we went, it was just, yeah, 200 punk kids that had just shaved their mohawks that day, you yeah. know, like.
So at this point, are you guys just going out every weekend when you're in
yeah.
school?
Oh, yeah, mm-hmm. every weekend and recording, like, constantly. Like, we recorded 5 albums before we were done high school.
Well, yeah.
if you include the old demos, we did 8, you know, so we were in the studio all the time.
So the next thing, I guess, that comes out is the Break It tape?
Yeah, Break It was Break It is the same album as
If the Music's Loud Enough.
If the Music's Loud Enough. It's just a couple of songs overlap and a couple that don't. Like the song Break It, but they were all If the Music's Loud Enough was recorded in 2 sessions. Half of it was recorded in the fall.
Yeah.
And half after the tour, and then we wrote a little more, and then half was recorded in the spring, and then it came out in the summer. So and Break It was a little teaser because Rancid and AFI took us out to Winnipeg and back.
Okay.
And we wanted something new to sell. So, but we couldn't afford to press CDs because back then it was actually still expensive.
It was so expensive.
And CDRs didn't really exist they were $30 each for a CDR.
Yeah.
So yeah, we just cranked out a bunch of tapes and blasted those out. Probably did 500 maybe. And I really like that little tape.
Actually. Oh, I love that tape.
Yeah.
I think there's also a song on the Snow Jam compilation came out. PE, I think, originally
PE,
came
yeah,
out.
Yeah, that might have also been on the Break It tape, too.
It's on the Break It tape, but I think it first came out on, well, at least I first got it on the Snow
Jam. Yeah, we would have done Snow Jam, too. That's right, yeah.
So would that be your next tour, the March break? I think after that first summer tour, you guys would have come back.
Yeah, pretty close, too. Like, I think maybe Snow Jam was before Rancid, actually. Oh, no, it wasn't.
No, it was after. It was definitely after.
Yeah, okay. Then, well, you're the expert.
Well, no, exactly.
Yeah. No, we would have done Snow Jam for the winter, and then Rancid. Yeah, so that year, that was probably the year I was in grade 11, actually. That was probably 1995 or something.
Yeah, it would have been,
yeah. So I would have, and I graduated in 96. So I would have been in grade 11. It would have been the winter, like after New Year's Eve in grade 11.
Morgan Brooker and I got drunk the night before, and he vomited into my bathtub. In my basement, and it, because you know, it's concave, it shot all up the wall.
Oh, yeah.
And I had to clean off. He was sleeping over before we went to see DBS the next day at Snow Jam. Awesome.
Great. Yeah.
What was that tour like? Like, that would have been.
Yeah,
like, that would have been.
Blink before they were Blink 182. Yeah. Just Blink. And Youth Brigade, Bouncing Souls, who's one of my all time favorite punk bands of that era.
SNFU, I love you, was Bouncing Souls.
SNFU played a date or two, but not all of them, if I recall correctly. I mostly remember Blink and Youth Brigade and Bouncing Souls and
High Standard,
that's right. And and maybe what's
Body
it?
Jar? No, Pry Bowl.
I don't remember them.
No Fun at All.
No, I don't think so. Or maybe it was a Noise for Name, or maybe it was Legwagon or Strung Out. It was one of those skate punk bands. I don't remember which one, though.
No, I think it was Ten Foot Pole and Noise for Name.
Ten Foot Pole, that's who it was. Ten Foot Pole. And, that was super fun. And that was playing for, you know, in Montreal. Toronto actually was one of the smaller shows. Like, that we played for maybe 700 or 800 people.
It would have been like 700 or 800 people, but that at like... I can't think of any of those bands drawing 700 or 800 people now, right?
Montreal, we played for 2,000 people.
Holy.
And there's actually a video on YouTube of that show. You can see a video of that, yeah. That's one of the few pieces of DBS footage that exists on the internet.
Snow Jam, it was like a Montreal, kind of like a company promotion of Greenland.
I think so, yeah.
And it was like meant to be kind of the... winter equivalent of the Warped Tour.
That's right. Yeah, totally. And it was really big. Quebec City was also huge. Playing like a upstart like hockey arena. That was really big. And we played Sudbury, and that was pretty big. And Toronto was pretty big. And it came to Vancouver, but Vancouver was already kind of getting past a lot of those kinds of pop punk bands. Like we didn't play the Vancouver show for one reason or another. We weren't asked to play it. Mm-hmm. It was at the Commodore, which holds 1,000 people, and there was probably about 150 people.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was like nothing in Vancouver, which I thought was really weird. I don't think it was weird. I actually sort of expected that it would be smaller, because I was keen on what people were into. But yeah, people were, I think at that point, Vancouver were getting more into hardcore, mm-hmm. into pop punk. They were kind of growing from there. I think maybe pop punk hit Vancouver pretty quick, too, because like Green Day was touring here all the time, and like before they were famous, and pop punk was pretty popular
here. And the pop punk got taken up differently here. Like, it wasn't so much that kind of like skate punk.
It was
vibe.
Less that kind of thing, yeah. Like bands like Strung Out, Legwagon, Noise for Name, those bands were a little less popular.
Yeah,
like
it was more minty kind of stuff.
Exactly.
Like
a little
Lookout.
People were a little more into the Lookout Records.
Yeah.
Like more like either like kind of crustier pop punk or more bubblegum.
It was the land of the smugglers, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so. That was more like what Vancouver's were into. And I remember going to Toronto and like seeing all the skaters that like. I thought SoCal has a bigger influence on Toronto and for sure on Montreal than I felt at Vancouver. Vancouver, I felt, had more of a Berkeley kind of influence.
Yeah,
like,
definitely.
Yeah, Rancid and you know bands like that.
So after Snow Jam, you guys kind of get back, and then I guess, like, the next thing I would have seen you guys on, which would have been the following summer, and I guess, once again, you're just playing weekends still, mm-hmm. kind of leading up to that summer?
Yep, totally. And also, spring break is a week long, and it's got a week on either side, so it's 9 days. So we would take an extra week off. We would talk to our teachers and be like, give us an extra week because we're doing this thing.
Yeah.
And they allowed us, and that meant that we could do, like 2.5 weeks in the middle of March, too, so...
So, and then you guys kind of came back, and I guess it would have been Falling Sickness and Anti-Flag, right?
Yep, totally, yeah. We toured with Anti-Flag and Falling Sickness we toured with Anti-Flag for 2 months. All of Canada, I think we did 3 weeks across Canada, and then 7 weeks in the States. Like, we did the entire Eastern Seaboard, Florida, the whole South, heavy California, into the Midwest, back across, into the Midwest, up. And then we drove back, and then did Vancouver, and we went across Canada again, to Winnipeg, and then drove back. Yeah, that summer we did 2.5 months of touring.
You also played in Toronto, I think, for a week, because you remember, like, 4 or 5 shows.
We did a ton, yeah. We parked ourselves in Toronto for a whole week.
Played Spiderland Acres, that crazy punk fest.
That's right, yeah, Spiderland. Oh, I saw things that night that I've never forgotten.
That is one of those places, yeah. Spiderland Acres, where I don't think it happens anymore, but when you walked in and people were offering you...
anything.
It was like something that would happen in downtown Vancouver.
Oh my god, yeah. I saw a guy walking around, he jumped on the hood of our van, we're driving through the Spiderland woods to get to the stage, and then it's like a man jumps on the hood of our car or our van. He's completely naked, and his genital warts have grown to the point that they've swallowed up his penis, and it's just a mound that looks like cauliflower protruding from his groin, and he's on the hood of our van. I'm looking at his overgrown genital problem, and I'm just thinking, what makes that happen to a person? And he's like a demon on the van, like trying to scratch through the glass. And I'm like, what? You know, like, what?
You guys are like 17.
I was like, what is happening? Yeah, like, this is
a bunch of 17-year-olds touring in a bread truck, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, I just remember being like, okay, now I know why my teachers wanted me to read Lord of the Flies to prepare me for this scenario. High school matters. I get it now. Yeah.
So,
It was gross.
That would have been, yeah, really
gnarly. I've never forgotten it.
I don't know where to go from that. Yeah, you know, exactly.
It's been 20 years and I still remember. Oh.
He was like 17.
Oh my God.
Looking out the window.
Scared shitless.
So by this point, you know, are you kind of getting into different types of stuff musically? I remember talking to you, you were really into Crimpshrine.
Crimpshrine is one of my all-time favorite bands. Like, Crimpshrine at 15 were like two, those were like my favorite.
Yeah.
Bands. Yeah, like I loved them. And Descendants were my all-time favorite. But like Crimpshrine 15 and like, yeah, I was really into that. I really liked, I like pop punk when it's a little rougher. You
yeah.
know? Like I really, I always have, you know, when it gets too clean, it isn't my favorite.
Do you like Leatherface and stuff?
Yeah, I love Leatherface for sure. Yeah, yeah, especially Mush. I love Mush. And Jawbreaker, easily my top five. I love 24 Hour Revenge Therapy. It's one of my all-time favorite albums. Heavily influenced the DBS and more and more. And things got on and we started experimenting more, you know.
Yeah,
and,
I was going to say, when did you guys, because I guess the next time I would have seen you in Toronto would have been, I guess it would have been almost a year later.
Yeah.
You came back and I saw you. Grade and Avail played.
Yeah, I remember. I got that show too.
Yeah, and you guys and I ran into you at the show, and we were all going to go see DBS because you guys were playing up at the street
Elmo.
With Doom.
Yeah,
at the Punk Fest,
right?
And I remember seeing you there and being like, "Oh, you're here," and you're like, "Mary, like you're here to see Avail," and you're like, "No, I'm here to see Grade."
Yeah, we discovered the first Grade records. Like I guess they're kind of, I don't know which one.
The split with Believe,
and then two other 7-inches, both by a French band called Jasmine.
Okay.
And Jasmine, I think they must have influenced Grade too, because they had just that style of screaming where it's so high pitched and completely horror movie styles like screaming. And I'd never heard that before.
Yeah.
And Grade and them, they both were taped to me by a friend of ours called Tebow, who later on became our roadie for years.
Mm-hmm.
And was one of my best friends this day.
I think he sings with you on stage at that show I brought up earlier.
Probably.
In the gymnasium when you do Keep on Rocking the Free World.
Yeah, probably, yeah, because he was that kind of guy. He was like our Bobo from Avail.
Yeah,
he was our guy.
Yeah.
And he loved, he was French, and he loved obscure music and obscure punk rock, and he made us a tape that was all this obscure emo core, and it had the Grade, Believe, and the Jasmine records. And when we toured France, I found the records, and I was like, ah! And I was like, I was so happy about it. But I found them in a bunker, like in Normandy, like at this squat. But so we heard that and we're like, now this is how we want to go. Like we want to get weirder, we want to get darker,
yeah.
We want to start screaming and doing crazier shit and also get more melodic at the same time, you know. So we just started evolving towards that, and it felt really natural. It seemed like a shock, I think, to some of our fans because we didn't care about. Like, this was all part of this kind of attitude we had where we're like, we didn't want to do the popular thing. We just wanted to do what we wanted to do. And we're like, we threw away all our early material. We stopped mm-hmm. playing it all together. We threw mm-hmm. away four albums worth of material, basically. Like about 90 songs were on the no list. And only about 8 or 9 were on the yes list.
Yeah, was there any songs? Because there were some... No, wasn't there?
One or two.
Red or something?
There was a couple that we liked that we felt were sweet and they evolved in. But and our fans, they get so mad because they just be like, we came and we wanted to hear all our favorite songs and you played none of them.
Yeah.
And we're like, well, we don't care. We're like, we don't do what you want us to do. We don't do what's going to be good for our band or our career. We're just going to play whatever songs we want to play. These are what inspire us right now. That's all we're only doing is inspiring us. And as a result of that, every tour we did, we were playing the next album, and no one had heard that album yet, which from a marketing standpoint is like suicide, you know? But we didn't care. We actually wanted to, like, we were just like, we wanted to be an underground band. It was kind of like the opposite of what most bands want. And we became it. We managed to go from selling, like, 20,000 albums to only selling 2,000, but people that really, like, liked our band a lot in a different way.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. And these records now, like, my brother is fanatically trying to acquire all your material. And some of these records go for hundreds of dollars.
They're hard to get now. Yeah. I don't have them all.
It took me forever to get a Snowball 7-inch.
Yeah, they're hard to find.
Ever. One of the things that I think is amazing about the stuff that you wrote back then as a lyricist is, like, if I look back at the stuff I wrote at 15... If I look back at the stuff I wrote at 25, I am ashamed and mortified of a lot of those lyrics. You wrote some crazy lyrics back then. Like, Axiom is a song that I can still go back and listen to, and I think those lyrics are some of the best anti-religious song lyrics ever recorded in punk rock.
Yeah, Andy Dixon wrote that song.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, totally. Okay. Well, I mean,
yeah, so there, that's why. I think, you know, Andy wrote, you know, well, we both wrote a lot of lyrics. But
yeah.
I think that particular tune, though, is for sure Andy. Yeah, I know for a fact, yeah.
So what were your guys' influences as lyricists back then? Because it was a lot more political, but also, like, it was more personal than, like, a Propagandhi or someone else was doing, right?
Blake Schwartz and Bach, for sure, was a big one, you know? Like, I used to just read his lyrics, you know? Just, like, I buy the John Rick, I'll just read it, you know? Like, I loved it. And my favorite, probably, like, my favorite lyricist, or one of my favorite writers, period, is Aaron Cometbus.
Mm-hmm.
From Cometbus Fantasy, and he was the drummer in Crimp Shrine,
yeah.
But he was also the drummer and songwriter in Pin at Gunpowder.
Yeah.
Billy Joe Armstrong was the lead singer, but Aaron Cometbus was a songwriter.
And did he sing also in Crimp Shrine on some songs? Like,
probably.
It's not always Jeff Ott, right? Like,
yeah, it's not always Jeff Ott. Yeah, it's probably him sometimes, too. Yeah, I can't remember which ones are which. I don't know if I could. They're both like, it's pretty hard to identify their voices. Despite the fact that they're pretty distinct. But,
yeah.
But, yeah, so, and Jeff Ott was a huge influence to me, for sure.
Yeah.
And then later on, I actually, truth be told, I actually had a 15 tattoo. It's right there.
Really?
Yeah, you can still sort of see it.
Yeah.
It's covered up now. He started going on a weird religious, like, trip and kind of became a born-again Christian. I think maybe Alcoholics Anonymous, like, put him on that kind of Christian trip. And then I got the tattoo covered up because I was like, I'm not anti-Christianity anymore, for the record. I'm open to people of all religions, but when I was a teenager, Andy and I both, as lyricists in DBS, we were like, you know, fuck religion, you know? And on some days, I'm still like, they can all fuck themselves. But most days, I mean, I'm tolerant of people's beliefs because I'm older and wiser. And I, you know, we're always tolerant of everybody anyways, but we just, like, wanted to speak our mind. And I think that was also, again, being defiant of coming from, like, a middle-class suburb, you know, mm-hmm. where... And North Van is not that white, you know. Vancouver is not that white. Like, there's a lot of white people here, but there's a lot of kinds of people here. And there's a lot of people with a lot of different religions in my high school. It was not a Christian place. It was an anything goes school. But for us, whatever it was.
You definitely, those lyrics, though, that, like, and especially the anti-religious lyrics coming in from, like, I was going to, like, an Anglican school at the time, mm-hmm. and, you know, beginning to question the religion myself, and just having, like, groups of kids my age tell me it's okay to question this stuff and not believe and not feel pressure to kind of fit into that. So I, like, you know what you're saying now, where it's like some of it might be extreme and stuff like that, but I think, you know, when you're a kid, you need extreme mm-hmm. language to speak to other kids.
That's right. Punk rock is about that, too. I think that also it's as much about being... It's probably more about being anti-establishment than anti-spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and I started, as my musical taste became more diverse as I got older as a teenager, I started to discover music from other parts of the world where spirituality is inherent in the music. And a lot of that music is actually what I listen to most of the time now. So, a lot of the music I listen to wouldn't exist without religion. So you know, and that makes me... You know, and then you travel more and you go to countries where people live in different ways. You know, once mm-hmm. you get outside of the Western world a little more and you start to see how people live in the Muslim world or live in different kinds of countries that have prominently different faiths, you begin to realize that, it's not so black and white. You know, like life is very complicated, society is very complicated, and religion serves purposes that serve different things for different people too. So yeah. I mean, I think that's what I don't want to go on a tangent here, but that's what makes me so angry about Canadian rhetoric and media right now, especially with the Conservative government of Canada demonizing Muslims and making them out to be terrorists, is that it's so fucking immature.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like, so, like, really, you think that religion defines someone's ethics as an individual or makes them a criminal? It's like you know, Mr. Harper, go see the world and come back and see if you still think that, because mm-hmm. it's childish. And it's, you know, if he was singing for DBS, except that we weren't racist like he is, then maybe we could be that radical. But as a grown man, Jesus Christ.
Well, it's that's the thing. It's like,
that's lame.
Well, it's just a lack of understanding.
It's just,
you know?
Ignorant. You know, it's ignorant. Most people grow up and their minds open and they become wiser, not become narrow-minded, like a squinty little... morons. But anyways, luckily we didn't suffer that, and we ended up becoming open-minded people when we grew up, despite the fact that I think that some of those lyrics are a little, I mean, they were inspiring at the time, but they're also to some people maybe, but I probably wouldn't write them now, I guess.
No, I know, but and I think that's the thing, is like, it's funny because, you know, as we get older, the music stays the same, right?
Yeah, it's
always there. But, like,
it is, yeah.
I don't know. Maybe it's because I've written some really bad lyrics that I really wish I could take back, that I just look back on those lyrics and I'm like, and I know some songs that you might be referring to where you're like, that might be a little too much.
Yeah, too much, yeah.
But I think it's amazing how many kids, and maybe it's DBS being the right age at the right time, were turned on to start playing music. Like, you know, you talk to the guys in the Lex on Fire, like all those guys, like myself, like there's so many people, but you know, I don't want to keep you too long because we're kind of coming to a natural end at this point and stuff, but
it's up to you.
But I just kind of like,
take,
well, for, we could do part two. I want to do a part two in the future and stuff like that. But like, you know, I just think it's so interesting because here you guys were as these kids and touching all these people's lives musically, but then, you know, yourself and Andy both have shaped Canadian music, Canadian alternative music, in a profound way in the 10 years after DBS kind of stopped being, well, like, I guess there's a little bit of an overlap with the label with Andy, but like,
yeah, I get people talking to me about this, about this from time to time. And I get people that email me still and stuff like that. And talk to me about the band. And I always, I'm glad for it. Like for us, like on a musical level, I feel like if we had any influence musically to people, then I think that a big part of why we were, this isn't to rob us of credit of being an original band, but I think that a lot of it was that also we were really into collecting records, which is a big thing. Like when we would go on all these tours, every day we'd hit the record store. Like we were all like, you know, I mean, Andy and I, we were record nerds, and we bought a lot of those Sears 7-inches, and some of these bands never made it to Vancouver, never made it to Toronto, never made it anywhere to Canada, and we, like I was saying about this French band, Jasmine, and we'd take influences from their styles, and reincorporate that into our style and blend it with what we were doing, and talk about the lyrics that were relevant to being a youth in Canada in the 1990s, and not just like, and people would hear it and be like, what is this, you know, and be really stoked, and then they would take that and move it forward. And when I listen to bands like maybe Alexis on Fire would be a good example, actually, I can hear that their influences are the same things that our influences were. And if they were influenced by us, and if we were a method of them getting through to that, then that's awesome. I mean, and that was us too. I mean, I another one of my favorite all-time favorite bands was Husker Du.
Yeah.
But a lot of my friends in Vancouver were influenced by Lifetime. And Lifetime was influenced by Husker Du.
Yeah.
And I was lucky enough to have older brothers and parents that were hip and stuff. So like I was already in Husker Du. I was in Husker Du.
Yeah.
But most people, they, you know, being from the middle '80s, you know, it's like, you know, you're a teen in the 1995. You're not necessarily going to listen to them. Now everybody knows them. But like Bounce of the Replacements and Husker Du were influential to me, and I put that in our music. Like Tales from the Crib to me was our Replacements. Sorry, Ma, I forgot to take out the trash.
Yeah, and
that's what that meant to me.
And I think that would be one thing if you guys hadn't, if that's where the influence stopped, but Andy with Ache Records putting out DFA 1979, Hot Hot Heat, and all the other kind of stuff he put out, like that's that first part of this decade. That's the alternative music in Canada. And now, like, you know, and you're obviously working with bands then, but even now, like White Lung, Japan Droids, Pac AD, you're kind of working with, certainly from this city, you know, a lot of the cream of the crop of the current wave of alternative music.
Yeah, so I mean, I just hope that I can always be involved in modern music, you know, like, it's funny, like, when I'm producing music, you know, to go there, it's like, well, I just think, I mean, I can't help but have whatever influences I have, like, every knob on the record, every knob of the console is being twiddled by me, and my brain tells my brain and my ear talk to one another, and they decide when that has reached the point that it's sweet. But the influences for me, like, so I'll listen to a record that I've done, is what I'm trying to say, and I'll be like, oh, I know this. I was totally robbing on this old record that I love, but other people haven't heard, and they think it's modern. Like with Japan Droids, the Brian's guitar sound, I've gotten multiple emails being like, what is Brian's guitar sound? How did they get that? And I was thinking, and that guitar sound to me is New Day Rising by Husker Du.
Yeah.
And I listened to that record, and I love that just that brittle, unwarm, cold, clinical distortion, like that. Just like that thin clinical distortion, that is the layer on top, and then there's other layers that go down below on that guitar sound. That the different frequencies in that guitar sound mean different things to me, but the very high frequencies in their sound, I figured out how to do it, and I stumbled across it by accident, and I was like, for this record, we got out the New Day Rise and Bob Mole guitars. But I bet you a lot of 20-year-old kids that are just discovering Japandroids and maybe discovering punk rock through them are like, man, their guitar sounds so original. Yeah. I'm like, it's Bob Mold, you know? But look at the Foo Fighters. They're influenced by Husker Du, you know? Like, yeah. Or Bob Mold. Like, he sings on the freaking records.
Well, yeah, it's funny because you bring that up, and I remember being like, yeah, I was just getting into Straight Edge one time, and we were talking, like, years and years ago.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, you know, Straight Edge, that doesn't start with, like, Minor Threat. It starts with
Modern Lovers.
Uh-huh. And you started talking to me about Jonathan Richman, and, like, you know, I'd heard of him, heard of Roadrunner, but, like... Yeah. I'm exactly well. They're the king himself tattooed on your arm.
Yeah.
But like, I'm straight and kind of like, you know, exposing me to that stuff.
That's radical. Incredible. At the time, it's like, nobody in 1970 was singing "I'm straight." That's just crazy.
And I say side two of that record is vastly superior to side one.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Once you get past the hits, then it starts getting like you're like, wow, it's got some deep shit.
Oh, heavy ballads
like,
on that.
Let me back into your life, like when you go to the hospital. Like,
holy shit, that song's heavy.
And then it's funny because you watch the Fugazi. I was probably talking to us at the time, but for the listeners of the podcast, when you watch Instrument by Fugazi and arguably Ian McKay,
this is before Instrument came out too.
Yeah, we were talking about this, but yeah, if you watch Instrument for Fugazi, that came out when I was like 19 or whatever, and like 1999 or whatever.
Yeah,
and I watched that video, and there's this very brief clip where it's Fugazi driving down the road, and you can hear what music they're listening to, and they're listening to "I'm Straight" by the Modern Lovers.
That's
and
awesome.
It goes by so quick, and I was like, I knew it. I was like, I knew that you were fans of Jonathan Richman, and now I've heard you listen to the record, and I know it's true because I saw it in the documentary, and I was like, I was talking to Damien, got back in Toronto, and I told him, and I was right.
Well, it's funny because you mentioned, you know, being a record collector, and that's like this influence that you see. If you look at any band that had an impact on alternative music, they're all record collectors.
Joey Ramone.
Yeah.
People wonder, how do the Ramones have this bubblegum, beautiful quality to it, you know, and yet they're still punk as fuck. It's like, well, they're a bunch of weirdos from Queens, some of them are drug addicts, some of them are, you know, on the streets, and then there's this guy, the lead singer, who loves this classic 60s, you know, Phil Spector produced, like, pop music and doo-wop, and he loves all this shit, and then you put it all together and you have this new sound.
Yeah, absolutely,
know?
Yeah.
This great sound. The Stones, the Dolls, you know, and then glam, you know, original pop glam.
Yep. And never, like, that's the thing about punk, too, is it never starts, you know? Like, the idea of, you get, like, you're like, okay, well, it's the Sex Pistols, then it's like, well, it's the Ramones, then you're like, well, it's the Electric Eels, or it's the Heartbreakers, and it's like, or not the Heartbreakers, sorry, Television. You take it back, you can always find, like, someone be like, no, it's this guy who recorded this 78 in 1923.
And whether you're punk music or rock music, or whatever kind of music you are with it under the rock umbrella, you know, you're still playing pop music.
Yeah.
And pop means popular song.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something, it's supposed to be referenced. It's meant to go on and on and on and evolve. So if we took things from Europe or from Grade or from whoever, and then people took us, and it was from Vancouver to them, you know, and they went on and did their thing, then that's the point, for sure. That's the point. So if we had any kind of a leg in that, then... I'm deeply proud of that. So, you know, I don't sit around and thank myself for it in the morning. But like, if I hear that from someone, I'm like, well, that's great to hear. I can't think of anything to be much more proud of. I would rather have done that for someone than be a generic band that made a ton of money. So,
yeah,
you know, or maybe didn't influence anybody or didn't contribute anything.
Why has there never been a vinyl reissue of any of the DPS records? I've always wanted those records on LP.
Yeah, there was none of them were ever on LP because this was the 90s when LPs were really fading out
when
quickly.
When vinyl was dead.
And CDs had finally gotten cheap enough and people were buying CDs like crazy.
Yeah.
HMV, Sound the Record Man, AMV Sound, all these like yours, blowing them out. We still did 7-inches. There was like 4 or 5 DPS 7-inches. We still did 7-inches and we saw that as a viable format. But LP was just too damn expensive. We couldn't make it. We didn't think it was justifiable for the cost. The big bands on Epitaph got to make it, but even some fat releases were CD only.
Mm-hmm.
I've never seen, I can't think of an example that would be a sound example, but I think that there are examples.
No, there definitely are. Like a lot of, I'm sure a lot of those records, like the vinyl was short run.
Yeah, or rare to find, or maybe not available.
Well, all those, like, a longest line original record now is like $1,000 or $500 record.
Yeah, there's you know? A lot of stuff like that. So you know, I guess like you know, there. I don't know if you know if the demand is there, it'd be a risky proposition. Like there was actually this one guy that he worked up in Fort McMurray. Him and his wife worked in the oil fields, and they were making a killing, just like making you know money beyond our wildest dreams. Yeah. And they had a ton of money, and he wanted to sink a bunch of money into DBS and pressing everything on vinyl. He wanted to do a box set. But the problem with that is that, well, A, that guy is a flake. And then the other problem with it is that I think that him and his wife split up, and I think that maybe she was the one that was making a ton of oil money. I think maybe he was more
spending the ton of oil.
I think he was spending the money. Yeah, he had the TV. I've still never seen a bigger TV. But, so there was talk about that. But, yeah, and for me, it's like, you know, okay, maybe I would break even on my investment, but even if I did, I don't want to do the work. You know, like, it took me 3 years just to get up the, like, I'm thinking about it, just to get the initiative to make the Bandcamp site to give away for free.
Yeah.
And I don't ever want to make any money off DBS because it was our politic of the day to only play $5 shows, only all these shows, and only work with DIY kids and not make money. That was our politic. We didn't want to make any. So we were just like, so to make that now, as so many bands reunite and do, I'm glad that those bands do that. I'll go pay $35 to see them. I got tickets to see the Replacements next week, and I paid $50 US for it because I got to see the fucking Replacements, and I'm glad they're coming. But I just like, I don't want to be that kind of band for us. I would rather us be this weird, obscure band that people still sometimes wonder about or talk about and find the records on Discogs or whatever. And I put it all up there for free so that people can have the music. So that was what I wanted to do. And actually, people donated, and I made about $150. So I actually owe Andy and Paul and Danny and Ryan, I owe them all $30 each right now because of the money I've stolen from DBS. So I owe those guys beers.
Well, yeah, and it also leaves the market open for my DBS cover band, which I'm forming with a bunch of people in Toronto that I've been threatening to form for years now.
I'll be at the show.
Okay, good. Awesome.
I'll be stage diving.
I might make you sing a song or two with the mic being thrust in your face at that point.
I'll sing it from the audience, but I couldn't get on stage because that would break the rule.
The violation.
Yeah.
It'd be a violation.
But I'll fly out and be at the show. I'll even pay $50 to go see the DBS cover a bad show.
What was the cash grab? I'm going to make more than you did off the Bandcamp already.
That's right, totally.
Because I definitely know a lot of kids in Riverdale that would pay more than $50 to see that too. So I'm going to make tons of money off this. I guess, like, you know, just to wrap up here, one thing I did want to ask about, because you guys did put a split out with them, DOA, was DOA a band that played a role in you guys?
Absolutely, yeah. Because Joey Shedd had put out Some Boys Got It, Most Men Don't. That was the first release on Sudden Death Records.
Yeah.
And part of our record deal with them was they took us to Europe, and we opened up for DOA for 6 weeks in Europe, and we played 44 shows.
Was that
44 shows and 45 nights.
Whoa.
We had one night off in Rome, and we played in 14 countries and 44 different cities in 6 weeks.
Was that your first time in Europe?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, first time being off the continent at all.
Yeah.
Yeah, for any of us, actually. Oh, maybe Danny. Oh, no, he was there because it was Ryan. I don't think any of us had ever even been outside of Canada or the United States yet.
Wow, so that must have been a crazy experience to go on.
Yeah, it was so crazy to me. Like, I was probably 19 and the guys were 18. The other guys were about 18. I probably just turned 19. Or no, I was 18 and they were 17. Whatever, we were out of high school. But it was so crazy to me that that I actually don't remember hardly anything of it, despite the fact I remember all these things before it, because I was just absorbing so much information that I wasn't actually smart enough to absorb it all. Like,
yeah.
I can remember all the countries we played in, but I can't remember all the cities. Like, we played 9 shows in Germany. I can remember about 5 of them. And
well,
you're
just seeing the back of a club a lot of times.
Oh,
right?
It's just like there's so much, and also, you know, smoking so much ash, too.
Yeah.
For sure. Like, that definitely was hard on the memory, you know, for sure. And I also drinking a ton of delicious German beer. So, yeah.
Good tour. What about Nardwuar? When was the first time Nardwuar would have interviewed
Nardwuar
you?
Has always been along with us in our career.
Yeah.
So actually, a lot of these questions, really, Nardwuar should be here for the interview to clear up the...
Well, believe me, Nardwuar is an interview unto himself, I think I want to get to.
Yeah.
Nardwuar
has been in my life my whole life. Nardwuar interviewed DBS many times throughout our career. He always asked questions about things that nobody knew the answer to. He asked us questions that the police didn't know the answers to yet, and I'm not exaggerating.
Oh, that brings up another question.
Yeah, you know, like he knew things that nobody should know. And Nardwar had a small stroke when he was about 31 years old. He suffered a small stroke, which landed him in the hospital for about a month or so. And thankfully, he's recovered entirely from it. Mm-hmm. And my brother was his therapist. My brother is an occupational therapist, and he helped Nardwar rehabilitate. And when Nardwar's mother was in the hospital because she was very, very ill, my grandmother had fallen down the stairs and she was in the hospital very, very ill. And they were in the same room in the beds beside one another. And it's my family and Nardwar together again.
Wow.
Again in the hospital 5 or 6 years later. Nardwar is one of those people that's always been in my life.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's a lot to Nardwar for me.
And one of the greatest interviewers we have in this country.
Yeah, one of the greatest of all time, period, yeah. One of the greatest of all time.
And I guess we'll like to wrap up now because I don't want to keep you all night. And as I say, I do want to get to a part two, hopefully one day where we can talk. Because I haven't asked you about the Piss Bomb the Nation World Tour shirt. I haven't asked you about the anti-flag split. There's so much stuff. And then also all the stuff after that as well.
There's a lot.
I guess... wrapping up is this where you thought it would go, like as far as music goes, because you're like one of the few people that really has lived your life in music.
Yeah, it is actually, like for me it was like, you know, because again, like coming back to like DBS, I think that maybe we could have made a career out of it at some point, at least for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But because of our politics, we chose not to. And for the record, I don't think there's anything wrong with that now. That was us being extreme DIY punks at the time. But I always loved recording. I always wanted to be a recording engineer, and making albums was one of my favorite things to do. Throughout high school, I recorded tons of albums, like just on cassette or on 8-track reel-to-reel. I recorded the early Submission Hold records.
Really?
Eastman. Yeah, I did Garlic for Victory. Oh. A lot of that was pressed on vinyl. I recorded that when I was 16 years old.
That 15 is crazy. I had no idea you did that.
Yeah, me and Steve McBean from Black Mountain and James Farrell from Bison put our gear together and recorded that record, and I mixed it and did the drums, and James did the guitars.
That record must have sold like something like 30,000 copies.
I don't know. Yeah, who knows? But I did all that. I did stuff, and I did DBS's last few records, and the Red Light Sting's first records, which is what Paul and Andy did after DBS, I always loved recording, and I never really wanted to be a musician for a living. Like, I wanted to always be a musician, and I've never stopped playing music. I've played way more music since DBS than I've ever done with it, but I haven't put that energy that I have. Like, when I put a lot of energy into a project, I can make things happen. I am naturally motivated. It's one of the gifts I have, I think. But I just wanted to put all my motivation into recording because like this all comes back again to records. Like, I loved collecting them. I loved listening to them. If it came down to live records, or if it came down to seeing a band live or only having records, like if I had to choose between live music or recorded music, I would choose recorded music.
Mm-hmm.
I love going to shows. I love going to the bar. I like drinking. I like hanging out. Like, I like everything about shows, but I just like... I love records more. Like, in my darkest times, those records are what I put on, and they matter so fucking much to me. So being able to produce records is what I love. And I still jam. I was at band practice last night. Still jam all the time. Got a new band, and I'm hoping I can put a lot of energy into this one. I'm feeling like I'm re-inspired to do that right now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. We'll see how it goes. I hope we can stick together and make lots of music, so... But I'm also really into the recording of that band as well. That's a big part. I have my vision for how I want the records to sound already sculpted out, too. So that's a big part of it for me. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Jess, for doing this.
Thank you
so much. No, I really appreciate it. It's been like this is one that I've really wanted to do for a long time and get to talk to you about this stuff.
Well, thank you so much. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you, Jesse, for coming on the show. And as I mentioned, that'll hopefully be just the first of many more to come with Jesse, because we barely scratched the surface of DBS and, of course, just touched on a little bit of the production stuff. But I'd love to get into it. Also, hopefully get Andy on the show one day from DBS. And, yeah, you know, I got big plans. And if you have no plans right now and are a fan of kind of gruff pop punk stuff, make it your plan to head over to that DBS Bandcamp page and just kind of wade through that massive free archive of music, because if you don't know that band, you are missing out if you're a fan of that kind of stuff, because they are
awesome. I love this band so much. I still love this band. Anyway, next week on the show, another band and another time that you're going to hear me kind of gushing like a fan again. It's Nate from Converge. Now, you've got to know Converge. And for those of you that don't know Nate, prior to being in Converge, which he's been a member of for years now, he was in Jesuit and Channel. We get into all that next week on the show. So please tune in. Go over to iTunes and subscribe to this. If you use iTunes, I know a lot of you don't for whatever reason. So if you do, please do subscribe to this. Leave some comments and feedback if you are so inclined. Head over to fuckedup.cc to see tour dates and check out Super Snack Brothers. And look forward to that thing that's going to drop soon from Vice that I'm doing, hopefully next week, but more on that next week. I'll talk to you soon. Thank you very much for listening. Go out and make your own culture, because if an idiot like me is able to make this much stuff, you got to be able to do it too, because trust me, you got to have it figured out better than I do. Anyway, see you next week. Stay safe. Thank you.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.